This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Front Row. I'm Lee Chui Lin. Gallery Weekend Kuala Lumpur is an initiative by Datin Shalini Ganendra to bring contemporary Malaysian art and design to local and global audiences in a bid to showcase its commercial and cultural offerings. It will also be hosting the Luminary Pulse sessions with two international speakers, Hanif Kara, a professor from the Harvard Graduate School of Design, and Christopher Phillips, curator, art critic, and academic. Both Hanif and Christopher are joining me now to discuss their work and careers. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So let's begin. Before we get into the specifics of what you both do, the concept of a gallery weekend, which is what this is, maybe a new one to many KLites and Malaysians. What is a gallery weekend?
I think the first gallery weekend that I remember took place in Berlin in the early 1990s. At that point, there was a new, vibrant art scene springing up in Berlin, and the gallery people felt that they really wanted to attract a wider audience. So they simply organized a group of walking tours of galleries. It gradually expanded over the years to include special exhibition openings, conversations between critics and curators and collectors. And gradually it had a remarkable effect of activating the art scene in Berlin, and it became a kind of model which has been adopted around the world. I think that is exactly what it's hoped will happen in KL with the gallery weekend that's upcoming.
Both of you are here to give talks as part of this. Could you tell us about your backgrounds? How would you describe your career paths? Because reading about both of you there, there are a lot of different descriptions of what you both do.
Okay. So mine is more science-based. So in that sense, my experience of gallery weekends is different from Christoph because he's an insider. I'm kind of an observer or an outsider. So I'm a pure structural engineer by profession. And maybe about 20 years ago, I realized that it was at the end of the professions in some way, and you had to reach out for bigger and better pieces. And I've done that through being more involved with wider cultures like art, music, and architecture. So probably the last formative years of my career have been more orientated towards design, which can range from designing a pen to designing a tall building. How do you engage with the wider conversation? And often that has included work with artists as well.
Christopher?
I think my career in the arts started in the 1990s when I worked for about 10 years as an editor at a magazine called Art in America. It's one of the top monthly art magazines in the U.S. And it was a wonderful job for me. I couldn't believe I was actually getting paid a salary to go around to the galleries day after day and talk to the gallery owners and meet with artists. Over the years, I formed friendships with a number of very good artists, and I started organizing exhibitions myself, at first on a small scale and then more and more ambitious shows. And eventually I received an offer from a New York museum called the International Center of Photography to join their staff as a full-time curator. I spent 16 years working at ICP and had a wonderful time there, worked with really terrific artists and photographers and video makers around the world. But over that time, too, I started accumulating a lot of administrative responsibilities. And within the last 3 or 4 months, I decided it was really time to make a change and to get back to doing the things that I enjoy and the things I'm good at. So I'm now working for a private art foundation in New York, and I will be helping that foundation expand its holdings of contemporary Asian art. I'll be organizing 4 exhibitions in the next 2 years and preparing a major book.
How would you define what a curator is or what a curator does? I mean, of course, the simplest answer to that is someone who curates, but obviously, mm-hmm. I mean, it's a much deeper responsibility than that.
Well, today there are curatorial training programs associated with art history departments everywhere around the world. And I think if you ask 10 different curatorial studies students what it is they want to do as a curator, you would probably get 10 different answers. It's really completely, it's a wide open field right now, and I think that's what attracts a lot of innovative and talented young art historians to the profession of curating. Personally, I would say I'm old-fashioned. I like working with individual artists, and I feel that what I'm good at doing is interpreting the work of that artist to a wide audience and presenting that work in its most compelling form.
And so that is how you would define a sort of successfully curated exhibition, if it's done by yourself? I mean, that's how you'd feel, okay, I've done a good job with this.
That's one of the approaches that I use. I have also worked on completely crazy curatorial projects with colleagues in China. The kinds of massive group exhibitions where you have about 150 people, artists, taking part in the show, and you have 12 weeks to come up with a list of participating artists, contact them, get the works to China, get them on the walls, and produce a catalog. That is a crazy way to work, but it sometimes produces very spontaneous and unpredictable results, and I find that a very satisfying way to work as well.
From my perspective, it's slightly, I translate that word differently, because curators in the built environment have to think over 30 or 40 years. They're usually the people who make cities, and they curate the way in which a city might be built or destroyed. And in specific terms, whether it's a developing part of the world or a developed part of the world, policymakers, politicians, and architects are usually the people I connect with that word, although I understand the specificity of an art curator or a music curator. The difficulty they have is they have to do instant reactions, and it's high pressure. The stuff that we get involved in takes many, many years, because it can actually involve many different people at different times, and it often takes 30 or 40 years to understand what the initial vision might have been of the curator.
I think something that you're both touching on is, in some ways, we are entering a space in which you can create careers that did not exist before, or you can kind of reimagine careers. And one of the things that struck me, Hanif, about what you were talking about earlier is that you're a structural engineer by profession, but that's no longer kind of an adequate description of what it is that you do. How would you describe being a design engineer? I mean, what is that really?
I think that it requires one of the things you need to do with the professions today. It's quite commonly known that you become an expert after 10 years of, you know, once you graduate 10 years or so in most of the science disciplines, you can become an expert. But you can't survive without expertise. So you need additional professions or additional behavior patterns. So in my case, what I learned was that I can make buildings stand up. That is my profession. That's no longer of question. The questions was, could I reorientate some of the questions that people ask of structural engineers? Is how do you, for example, defy gravity? How do you do things that are moving? How do you do things that affect the senses rather than make you feel safe in an earthquake? These are the other types of things that require you to think beyond your scientific numbers, let's say, where you have to then engage with cultural institutions. The essence of it comes from a goal of trying to improve quality of life. And I think that that is probably what has changed for me, because I've learned that as it globalizes, you start to see the difference between the world in a particular way, rather than structural engineering 30 years ago when I qualified. It was straightforward, you know, you were just trying to make buildings stand up. But as you see the differences in how you could improve the world, you start to get engaged in the narratives of design, which range. I mean, there's so many projects I could talk about, but I'm resisting that. But they range from cities asking themselves questions to difficult architects asking the city a question, to sometimes the mayor of a particular city might want to do something that the public doesn't like. And often it's now a meritocratic curation, where a popular movement wants to do something in a city that then is engaged with. So if you're a professional as an architect or engineer, you have to learn to adapt to that way of reacting.
Was that adaptation and that move towards being more design-oriented a natural one for you? I mean, was it something that you were already interested in and it was a natural marriage, or was it something that you consciously thought, okay, I need to start refiguring how I think about things?
I think that it was a conscious decision, and I think, like most of us, there's a personal frustration or something that has happened to you in your life that tells you that you could make a bigger difference. In my case, it's being a migrant moving from Africa into a Western society, and then being educated in Western society and recognizing I could offer a bit more than what is normal. So from that frustration, you start taking some risks, and in my case, being lucky, people respond well, which encourages you, and you soon realize actually that it's connected to lifelong learning. So you've got to change your way of what you've been taught and learn that and try and re-educate the disciplines, which is where I've got engaged with more as an educator, which I get referred to as a Harvard professor, but I'm mostly a professional person who's turned to trying to educate rather than the other way around. And this is probably the why I got engaged with design, is I started also seeing that the training of designers or professions hardly ever engage with what the end product is. It was teaching methodologies and routinization of disciplines, but not really teaching how you affect people.
I'm speaking today with two of the speakers of the Luminary Pulse sessions that will be happening this weekend, Hanif Kara and Christopher Phillips. Up next, we continue talking about what it means to be a curator, what it means to be a design engineer, and how a multidisciplinary approach might change things. You are listening today to Front Row on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. You are listening to Front Row on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin, and with me today, Hanif Kara, a professor from the Harvard Graduate School of Design and a design engineer, and Christopher Phillips, curator, art critic, and academic. They're both here as part of Gallery Weekend Kuala Lumpur, and they'll both be giving talks. We'll get to that in a little bit. But first, so you've both been to Malaysia before, and since what we're looking at is sort of design and art, what is your take on our artistic identity and footprint? How would you describe us?
I visited Kuala Lumpur for the first time 5 years ago. I was invited by Shalini Ganendra to take part in her gallery's residency program. So I spent a week in KL and visited a number of galleries, talked to a number of museum curators and local artists. Having now returned after 5 years and having been out on the rounds already today talking to some of the new gallery people, it seems to me that there is considerably more activity in the contemporary arts in Malaysia now than I saw 5 years ago. I think just based on the conversations I've had over the last few days here in KL, I think there is a feeling that Malaysian art and artists are ready to have a wider audience, an international audience. Neighboring art scenes in Singapore and in Indonesia have accomplished that already, and I think there's a feeling that, yes, we can do it in Malaysia too.
So I've had two types of experiences. I came originally to Borneo with a family, with my two girls and wife, really to do the tourist thing, but we actually just hired a car and traveled around that part of the world. And then subsequently, and probably more relevant to this conversation, I've had a number of experiences in Kuala Lumpur, both as a practitioner but also as a judge. So I was fortunate enough to be on the Aga Khan Master Jury for the Petronas Towers when they were selected for the awards. I reviewed the airport for the Aga Khan Award for Architecture. I also reviewed the Petronas University, which was with Tamil American Architects and Norman Foster, which also won an award. And then subsequently, the seminar for that award, which is quite a big thing in Malaysia. I think it was the first time, or maybe one of the early times when your modern buildings were being recognized, throughout the world, because that award is considered to be a high quality design in a sense. I've also pitched for buildings here, so I came with Zaha Hadid for the two towers at the KCCLP about 2 years ago, which never got built, but nonetheless I've been in the design scene, in KL in particular.
And how would you describe our architecture, I suppose, our design in terms of our lived spaces, in terms of our city?
Well, again, I think it's common. It's not just KL. There's obviously two types. There is the towers and the modern
the skyscrapers.
Stuff, the skyscrapers and what the city is made of. And then there is the outskirts and what is considered to be local or regional. I don't know enough about the regional stuff, because people assume you don't need an engineer or any design in that kind of stuff. My own opinion is that it does, and there should be some more work done researching that part of the construction, let's say. And I'm pretty sure you'll find more art in that area as well, which I don't know about. But predominant experiences have been in your hotels and in your tourist expansions, let's say, but also the city in KL, which currently, you know, it rates amongst the best in Southeast Asia. So it's got the fortune of being in the right place with the weather and the climate. But I think the early investment, certainly 20, 30 years ago, in particular, the Petronas Towers, who I think at the time may have been controversial, but looking back, you know, they set a massive symbolic but as a construction standard that everybody else has to live up to for one reason or another. And that, I think that's a very good compass for the architecture. I'm not convinced that everybody follows the good compass. There are some really awful buildings in the center, but that's not peculiar to KL.
No, certainly not.
It's anywhere and everywhere in the world. The question is whether you have the patience to go back and follow the good compass again.
Christopher, earlier you referenced working with artists out of China and Japan. How do you go about acquainting yourself with the visual information and knowledge to curate a well-rounded program when it is, you know, I don't want to use the word exotic because that's not what I mean, but, you know, when it's something that seems far-flung, or when it is a language or a culture that is very much its own thing and can be very separate from, you know, from what America might think of in that sense.
I've always tried to partner with local curators when I do a group exhibition featuring artists from a country whose culture I may not be absolutely familiar with. I have found it very productive to pair with curators in China or Japan or Korea, so that we're coming at the material from two different perspectives. But if you do it right, those perspectives end up meshing and throwing the work of the artist into a new kind of relief. The other thing that I regularly do is I try to stay in contact with the artists whom I think are the most serious and the best informed in the countries I'm interested in. And I ask them, who do you see? Who are the young artists who are coming up that you think are doing something that hasn't been done before and that would be of interest to art audiences outside of your country? That has worked very successfully. I would never try to just buy an airplane ticket and land in a city that I don't really know and spend 3 days looking around galleries and organizing an exhibition on the basis of that. I think that would be a recipe for disaster.
And when we look at how photography and the camera in that sense, how that has rose or risen in places like the United States and then conversely here in Asia, are our aesthetics and approaches very different?
I think that because photography was invented and first developed in Europe and North America, there is a kind of historical perspective on photography in those areas that you don't find anywhere else in the world. You also find really only in Europe and North America obsessive collectors who are amassing important collections of historic and contemporary photography and often donating those collections to leading museums. I don't see that really happening anywhere else in the world. It will eventually happen, but
there's a head start.
There is a kind of historical blockage there.
Has the role or the concept of what it means to be a photographer changed through the years? I mean, now, of course, we have this conversation all the time, partly because of the easy availability of cameras. Has it kind of evolved in that sense?
I think in the last 15 or 20 years, as everyone is aware, photography has been part of the digital revolution that has changed the lives of everyone on the planet. I've been teaching at New York University in the photography department there for many years, and I've watched this revolution unfold. Today, when I teach a class of undergraduates at NYU, those students are writing their own computer code. They are working with multimedia programs and not only working with still images, but moving images as well. And now they are starting to design 3D immersive digital environments. If this isn't a revolution, I don't know what is. And it keeps me on my toes, just trying to stay abreast of what the students are doing.
Hanif, earlier you referenced how you have a different perspective, partly coming from Africa, for example. And I understand that you were born in Uganda and you went to England at 14 because Idi Amin expelled the entire Asian community at that time. How did that impact your life? You know, kind of having that, I imagine it would have been a huge, it would have given me whiplash.
Yeah, I think that it's so easy to think of the negative side of it. I always think that I could never have achieved what I have had that not happened to me. So from every destructive force, you can create something constructive. And what happened, I think, to many like me, and it's continuing to happen today when migrants are moving again, there's a big shift going on, is I got a type of education that I would never have got where I was or where I was born. And that combined with the upbringing or the formative years from a different culture and eating different food and all that created a more positive impact on wanting to do better and more all the time. I think the second component in my particular case is that kind of early insecurity makes you realize that material values are less important than what you have in your brain in a way. That's something nobody will take away. They can kick you out of any country they want, but if you've developed a cultural skill or a skill in particular that you can keep with you, you don't need to take it, because most of the East African Asians had to leave in 90 days and left everything behind. So anything material did mattered very little. So hence my interest also in education, because I think that's been the transforming fact. I've found it to be mostly positive in being in Europe. You know, I wouldn't want to be anywhere else but London, frankly.
One of the things that came to mind when thinking about what it is that you do and the creation of cities in some ways is this notion of placemaking. And you mentioned London.
Yeah.
London is old. It's sprawling. It has a very fixed identity. When people think of London, you know, there is a very specific idea of how London looks. Much of London is old in that sense. It was laid out before that. How do you build something new in a place like London? How do you place make when the place has been made, you know, before you got there?
I think London is fortunate in that sense, but it's also sometimes used as a we can't do that model because
yeah.
we're new, and that's not always true. In London, being specific about it, I think the most important things are that we have a very difficult planning regime. So to build anything takes several attempts and the consultation processes are driven by policies that have been developed over many years. So the intellectual aspects of what a city constitutes have been built up for many, many years. That is something that's good. So it's got a very smart blueprint, despite the fact that the streets are still Victorian and much of our built heritage is still Victorian. It tries to protect a lot of that. And then we also have what I call the taste police. You know, there are a lot of people in London who are always the public who will object to their areas being destroyed. But there are also formal organizations. We don't have one right now, but we had the Commission for Architecture and the Built Environment that the government had set up as an independent body that was protecting the quality of public buildings. So you couldn't just build anything anywhere. So all those gates that you have to go through, I think, whilst it may be very difficult for developers because they can't get to build quickly and as much as they want, has protected the city enormously. I think that that also becomes quite difficult in the conversations I have in the Middle East or other parts of the world where people are wanting to move rapidly and the urbanization is growing at a pace, because the perception is that you can't necessarily put in all those things because we have to get people living in these places quick. And I think that's very dangerous, because I think one of the values of London has been through that mechanism, the infrastructure. You know, we have sewers that were built 200 years ago that's still standing. And that is allowing the city to adapt and readapt. And what I find is that in many of the developing parts of the world, often, literally, you turn up to a building, there's no road to it, and the water hasn't got there yet. You know, there's no infrastructure constructed around it, because that is a public civic activity, not the developer's activity. So I think there is there are a few things that we learn from the West and can apply to the East and vice versa. London itself is fortunate, though. It is pretty unique because it is one of the global cities. So you can probably afford to do things you can't afford to do elsewhere.
You're both giving talks this weekend. What will be the focus of your discussions?
I'm going to give a talk tomorrow examining the work of three contemporary artists who all work simultaneously in multiple art mediums. This is a style of working that has flourished among younger artists for the last 5 or 6 years, and I think it may be of interest to people in KL to see how artists keep so many different aesthetic balls in the air simultaneously without dropping them.
I'm going to talk about design as a third culture, which I'm springing off the idea that the scientific revolution for the last 40 or 50 years dictated many of the cultures, and that was not always a good thing. So I'm going to show some projects that I've worked with in collaboration with artists and architects that have been pioneering. They've changed the way we think of buildings, and then try and tackle the idea of what is the difference between multidisciplinary and interdisciplinary conversations.
That notion of being multidisciplinary, working in different disciplines, has that been a natural evolution for many in the arts? Is it just, you know, how it's done now? You know, people just expand in that way and keep those aesthetic balls up.
I would say it's been a long, slow evolution that has accelerated remarkably in the last 10 years or so. At one time, students attending art academies would all learn the basics of drawing, painting, sculptural rendering, perhaps printmaking, and that would essentially cover all they needed to know. Today, younger artists have the option of making videos, making photographs, combining those with drawings, with paintings, working with a whole range of different image-making possibilities. And I think it's one of the most exciting directions that is currently noticeable in the art field.
I tend to agree with everything that Chris says. I have, though, been teaching something different slightly, because I've also seen from that behavior, which in the built environment has come predominantly because of globalization, and the digital has allowed us to produce something for a purpose and a reason, or produce something for no purpose or reason whatsoever. And we see both examples. So what I try to do is actually reorientate what that means. Multidisciplinary, I think you've said somewhere that it's many people doing many things at the same time, but that can also be a very negative thing because they don't go deeply into any specific thing, which
That's my concern. I mean, is there that worry that, you know, you become jack of all trades, master of none? You dabble and dabble and dabble, but ultimately nobody will ever say, oh, this person was, you know, really great at this one thing.
I believe in the built environment. That is a grave danger. And the worst thing about it is that all the dabblers often end up producing buildings that you live in. That could be dangerous without any particular person holding the pencil. And I think that's a very nuanced approach to interdisciplinary rather than multidisciplinary, which is a much bigger discussion.
And on the art side, I mean, is that a worry?
It is constantly a worry that young artists will be spreading their activities so thin that the result is unsatisfying in a dozen different ways. However, I think there are a number of exemplary artists who have found ways to work simultaneously in multiple mediums, and to do so in such a way that there is a resulting depth of imagery or depth of ideas, and that's what I'm going to concentrate on in my talk.
There are 13 commercial galleries that will be participating in this first edition of the citywide initiative, Mapping the Multidisciplinary, this weekend. Can either of you tell me anything about the galleries? Not so much, but still, there will be 13 commercial galleries. And the Gallery Weekend KL 2016 is happening this weekend. It's starting off today and it'll run till Sunday, the 25th to the 27th of November. For more details on, well, all the different activities, including the talks that both Hanif and Christopher will be giving, as well as the 13 galleries involved, you can go to gw-kl.com and all the details will be there. Gentlemen, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I've been speaking today with Hanif Kara and Christopher Phillips. We've been discussing their work as well as the Gallery Weekend KL 2016. You've been listening to Front Row on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.